From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. We've got the best picks from our show this past Saturday and Sunday. I'm Becky Sullivan. I'm a producer on the show. First, our cover story. We couldn't help but notice something about the big news last week. From the Supreme Court to the George Zimmerman trial to Paula Deen, it was all about race.
So everybody knows that race is still an issue. It still matters. The debate is how.
We'll also get into one of the movie industry's big myths.
Women will go to men's movies if they're good, but men won't go to women's movies. Now, it's just not true.
And speaking of ladies in the movies, the man behind Bridesmaids in the new movie, The Heat, Paul Feig, gave us a little love letter to Casino Royale.
You feel like, okay, he can kind of get out of any situation, and yet, maybe he can't.
You'll also hear from Nick Walinda, the tightrope walker who conquered the Grand Canyon, but is far from satisfied.
I want to walk to the top of the Eiffel Tower. I want to walk over the pyramids in Egypt, the Great Wall of China.
And some great music from one of Venezuela's most popular bands. All that's coming up on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered with host Jackie Leiden.
This was a week in which the country was reminded of our continuing struggle with race. The conversation started with the actions of the Supreme Court.
Today, the United States Supreme Court lopped off the head of the Voting Rights Act.
It's considered one of the most important pieces of civil rights legislation ever passed.
The U.S. Supreme Court cast doubt on the future of affirmative action in higher education.
But it soon moved to events outside the Supreme Court.
From the beginning of one of the most highly publicized murder trials in recent history,
statements begin today in the murder trial of George Zimmerman.
The eruption over Food Network star Paula Deen.
So I'll ask it to you bluntly. Are you a racist?
No. No, I'm not.
Voting rights, affirmative action, the Trayvon Martin trial, and even celebrity chef Paula Deen. It all adds up to today's cover story, where we are in our conversation on race in America. To talk about this, we invited in our colleague, Gene Demby. He's the lead blogger for Code Switch, NPR's blog on race and ethnicity. We asked him to start out with Paula Deen, who this week has faced a groundswell of criticism about racial epithets she's used in the past. She apologized in a tearful moment on the Today Show.
I is what I is, and I'm not changing.
We asked Gene Demby what the Paula Deen saga says about race relations today.
Well, it speaks to a difficulty I think Americans have now with identifying discrimination. The Paula Deen conversation quickly turned into a conversation about the inner workings of her soul, right? Whether or not she was actually a racist. And so, you know, this is a stark difference from the days of George Wallace in the schoolhouse door barring black students from entering the University of Alabama, different from fire hoses and dogs attacking teenage kids. Because of the victories, the civil rights victories of the 60s, those kind of blatant expressions of racism became less socially acceptable. But discrimination and racism seems to still happen, but no one seems to know what they might look like today.
So, Gene, in the Paula Deen case, we see something that's really clear. We can say that's just inappropriate. Let's turn to the Supreme Court, where things seem to be murkier in these two rulings we had this week, one on the Voting Rights Act, the other, the University of Texas and the affirmative action case. Let's start with that. It's a little harder.
Yeah, affirmative action is a tough nut. I mean, support for affirmative action has fallen in recent years, especially among white people. People of color still feel really strongly that it should be in place. The Supreme Court is basically asking a lower court to parse the details of the University of Texas's admissions policy to see how they use race and to determine whether or not they use race in a way that is unfair. In the Voting Rights Act case, the Section 4, which is the part of the Voting Rights Act that determines whether or not a jurisdiction may have been discriminated against voters, was struck down. The Supreme Court said that the rationale that was in place when the Voting Rights Act was put into effect was, you know, voter tests, really obvious racism, right? Lower voter turnout. Those were the things that were the red flags. The Supreme Court said that that part of the law needs to be rethought. It could be replaced with something else, but we need to change the metric. The thing is that we don't know what the metric looks like in 2013. It's not going to be, you know, jars of beans and asking a person of color to guess how many beans are in the jar, as it would have been in like 1963 or 1964.
Last week, you wrote in the Code Switch blog about a new study from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Tell us about that.
That study was fascinating for a bunch of reasons. What the Urban Institute did is they took two people, one person of color, one white person, and they sent them to a real estate agent to inquire about houses for rent or for purchase. They did this 8,000 times in 28 cities. And what they found was, consistently, white people were shown more units than people of color were and were more likely to be offered lower rents. And it's important, people of color in these situations always said they were treated politely. They felt like they were getting the best service. And the only way anyone knew that anything was wrong was because you had this like aggregate data in which people were actually counting the number of units they were shown. And so these things are incredibly consequential, even though they're imperceptible.
NPR's Gene Demby, the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Jackie.
The court may have ruled that segregation as we knew it is a thing of the past and we've come to a different point, but does that mean that we've achieved racial parity? Professor Philip Atiba Goff deals with these questions every day.
So everybody knows that race is still an issue. It still matters. The debate is, how does it matter and how do we come to make sense of it?
He's a professor of social psychology at UCLA. He says that as a country, we've overcome some history.
Blacks were less valued than whites because that was just genetics and we can all agree on that. And then we've sort of, as a nation, decided that wasn't quite right. And as we've diversified, we've decided we don't want to make attributions to genes. We don't want to say that a group of people is just lazy, is just not trying hard, because we know that's not true. But we haven't replaced that with anything else. So instead, all we're left with is a language that just says, either you're racist or you're not, either you're lazy or you're not, and we don't have anything that's sort of worthy of the great anxiety we still have around racial inequality.
Goff advises police departments around the country testing their officers for biases. You might not be surprised to hear some of his findings. Racial bias in a cop can correlate with racial disparities on the street, but others you might not expect.
The more officers are worried that someone is going to call them a racist, the more likely they are to use force against Black and Latinos than against whites.
How could that happen? Cops, says Philip Goff, have two kinds of authority.
The first form of authority is my moral authority. I am a police officer, you should do what I say. If and only if that authority fails, should I use my second form of authority, which is physical authority. So now imagine you're a police officer, Black, white, Latino, Asian, what have you, and you're approaching a car full of young Latino men who are going to call you a racist. What kind of moral authority do you have? The answer is you have none. So if anything gets a little bit out of hand, you're more likely to use that other form of authority.
So in other words, solutions for police departments have to be much more nuanced. Philip Goff points to his work in Las Vegas.
They were having an issue where they were concerned about use of force generally. They just felt their officers were using too much force, and this was internally motivated. They said, we can do better than this. We don't have to be using force this much. It turned out a lot of their use of force incidents were occurring after foot pursuits. The suspect usually gives up because they're surrounded. Frequently, that's how it happens. So the person who did the chasing is usually the one who wants to put the handcuffs on, and you punch him once in the kidney just as a price for making you run, because that's a scary experience, running after somebody when behind any corner you could be hurt or killed. What they did in Las Vegas was they just said, whoever was doing the chasing on foot can't be the first person to lay hands on. And as a result, they've had a precipitous drop in use of force and a precipitous drop in racial disparities in use of force. They didn't make anybody more or less racist. They didn't have sensitivity training. What they did was they changed the situation. The situation changed the behavior, which in turn can change the attitude.
We've been discussing this week the ruling at the Supreme Court in which Chief Justice John Roberts said, we are different as a society. It sounds to me like you're saying we are different as a society, but that doesn't mean that we do not hold racial disparities as attitudes still.
So he got it right that we are different, but just because we are different doesn't mean that we are better. We see prejudice genuinely declining, because it is. And we see inequality being persistent or even increasing. And what do you do with that? Because we used to think forever that the root of all inequality was prejudice. And it turns out we were wrong. And we haven't yet begun to talk about, well, how do you get inequality even in the absence of prejudice sometimes? And as a result, he's looking around at the prejudice and says, I don't see very much of it. Therefore, we must be different in a way that allows this to be able to expire. Except that is, on its face, a kind of ridiculous logic, because the Voting Rights Act was used how many times in just the last election cycle? So if we don't have a problem with inequality, if we don't have a problem with unfairness of treatment, why are we still using those same outdated laws? We see prejudice declining and inequality persistent are going up, and because we as a nation have had a hard time looking at that honestly, now it's almost like we can't look at it at all.
Dr. Philip Atiba Goff of UCLA. And in response to his question, the Department of Justice used the Voting Rights Act 14 times in 2011 and 2012 to block discriminatory voting practices. Civil rights scholar Dorothy Roberts at the University of Pennsylvania had similar thoughts about the Chief Justice's opinion.
It reflects a colorblind constitution that sees civil rights amendments as requiring the government to ignore race and the court to only protect against blatant racial classifications of the kind that existed in the Jim Crow era.
The Supreme Court may be the most high-profile example, but she says that's a trend across all courts. It's harder these days, she says, to bring and win a case based on racial disparity.
For example, voter ID laws that appear to be race neutral, but we know they have a disproportionate effect on preventing voting by minorities. So those kinds of more subtle forms of discrimination that still have a very powerful effect to disempower and to prevent full participation continue to exist, but the court doesn't see that. And so in order to win, it's more and more important that plaintiffs be able to show the kind of smoking gun statements about racism.
Much of civil rights law has come about through litigation, Brown versus the Board of Education, Plessy versus Ferguson. In the context of these recent rulings, is litigation still the way forward?
I would say litigation is still important. However, with this recent set of Supreme Court decisions, the court is now actively dismantling or weakening laws, policies, and programs that have been put in place to address racist practices and protect against future discrimination. Therefore, with the U.S. Supreme Court no longer a champion, there is a need to use a variety of other strategies, like legislative strategies, institutional policies, like the University of Texas's affirmative action policy, and also let's never forget that the civil rights movement was a movement of people struggling to overturn an unjust system. And so protest by ordinary people is still important.
University of Pennsylvania law professor Dorothy Roberts. So as the old front lines of the race debate fade, new challenges are bound to emanate from a more pluralistic society. This week was just another installment in the essential and ongoing conversation about race in America. Summertime, the perfect time for a night out at the cinema.
Hollywood Hotel.
Maybe you've noticed something missing at the movies, like women. I'd like to say hooray for Hollywood, but women make up a minority of movie creators. 7% of the directors, 13% of the writers, 20% of the producers. That's nearly 5 men for every woman working behind the scenes. Our cover story today, Films Forgotten Females. Out of last year's biggest movies, 28% of the speaking characters were female. That's down from a third 5 years ago. Those numbers are from the Annenberg School at the University of Southern California. On a recent Saturday night in Washington, D.C., filmgoers milled about for a movie night.
Man of Steel.
The Bling Ring.
Monsters University.
And we were curious, have they noticed a lack of X chromosomes at the cinema?
Just based off of the last few movies I've seen, they've all just been really male-centric, like World War Z and Man of Steel and This is the End.
20-year-old Melissa Hattab.
Women see movies just as much as men do. I know that I love going to the movies, and I like seeing characters that I can relate to, but it's mostly just about the main character is the man, and then if there's a woman in it, she's just the love interest or is there to look hot and is really passive.
I don't think the women presence is lacking.
And that's 22-year-old Chancellor Gaffney.
Even like Sofia Coppola, she just directed The Bling Ring, and Amy Adams, she's co-starring in Man of Steel. I really don't feel there's like a shortage of women presence in film.
Tabitha Balcorgi says that's just the problem.
Everybody makes a big deal when Coppola directs a film. We're at a point in our time that it should be every day. But no, we still make a big deal about it because there's so few women doing it.
That's not to say no women are doing it. The heat has got girl power.
So my Spanx, they hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
This female buddy pick opened to big buzz this weekend, starring Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock. The screenwriter was a woman, Katie Dippold. It echoes the ultimate female buddy movie, 1991's Thelma and Louise, starring Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis.
Let's keep going. What do you mean? Go!
I asked Gina Davis about the buzz that surrounded Thelma and Louise.
Every time there's a movie starring women, the media is very excited to say, well, this changes everything. And that certainly happened with Thelma and Louise. Now there's going to be so many female buddy pictures. And nothing changed. And more recently, Bridesmaids and The Hunger Games. Well, now everything has changed, and it's not going to.
Lately, Davis has been busy trying to figure out why women aren't better represented in film and how to turn things around. She founded a think tank in 2004, the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media.
When my daughter was about 2 years old, and I started watching G-rated videos and little kids' TV shows and things, I was floored to see a huge dearth of female characters. I had assumed that surely we are showing boys and girls sharing the sandbox equally by now. I knew that there were fewer female characters in general in Hollywood. I'm in the industry and I've experienced that, but I didn't know that it applied to what we show to kids.
You commissioned a dozen studies on women in media from the Annenberg School at USC. Some of the figures just really boggle the imagination when you think that women are half of all moviegoers. If we didn't go to the movies, maybe this would make more sense, but we turn out in droves.
I know, it really does boggle the mind. In family films and kids' television shows, for every one female character, there are three male characters. But lest people think that it's all bad news, we were able to see an increase in the percentage of female characters in family films such that if we add female characters at the rate we have been for the past 20 years, we will achieve parity in 700 years. And my institute, we have dedicated ourselves to cutting that in half, and we will not rest until it's only 350 years.
Why is this the case?
My theory is that since all anybody has seen when they are growing up is this big imbalance, that the movies they've watched are about, let's say, 5-1 as far as female presence is concerned. That's what starts to look normal. And let's think about in different segments of society, 17% of cardiac surgeons are women, 17% of tenured professors are women. It just goes on. And isn't that strange that that's also the percentage of women in crowd scenes in movies? What if we're actually training people to see that ratio as normal so that when you're an adult, you don't notice?
I wonder what the impact is of all of this lack of female representation.
We just heard a fascinating and disturbing study where they looked at the ratio of men and women in groups, and they found that if there's 17% women, the men in the group think it's 50-50. And if there's 33% women, the men perceive that as there being more women in the room than men.
Oh, my goodness.
So is it possible that 17% women has become so comfortable and so normal that that's just sort of unconsciously expected?
Why else, Gina Davis, do these kinds of disparities matter?
What we're in effect doing is training children to see that women and girls are less important than men and boys. We're training them to perceive that women take up only 17% of the space in the world. And if you add on top of that, that so many female characters are sexualized, even in things that are aimed at little kids, that's having an enormous impact as well.
That's Gina Davis on her work with the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. Longtime producer Linda Obst has watched Hollywood undergo some seismic changes, and they haven't been good for women. When she began in the industry 3 decades ago,
you could make up an idea, pitch it to your boss, and if you were lucky and he liked the idea and you had a good writer, you could sell it, and it might even get made into a movie.
Obst calls those days the old abnormal, when she produced numerous hits, including Flashdance, Sleepless in Seattle, and One Fine Day. These days, says Obst, it's the new abnormal, trying to get studios just to pick up a movie.
What they want are ideas that are known around the world before they even get made, because it makes marketing the ideas even easier, which is, of course, why they want to make ideas that can easily become sequels and then become franchises.
Obst calls these movies tentpoles, dependable blockbusters. blockbuster brands like Spider-Man, X-Men, and Harry Potter. And she writes about the changes in her new book, Sleepless in Hollywood. So what exactly accounts for the new abnormal?
Between 2006 and 2009, the cushion that had allowed all of these one-off movies to get made, the DVD cushion that accounted for 50% of the profits of the movie business, had utterly collapsed in the wake of downloading and piracy, and people were no longer buying DVDs. And with that profit margin gone, the studios were paralyzed until they realized that there was only one revenue stream that was replacing the revenue stream that the DVDs had represented, and that was the international audience. At the same time as the DVDs were disappearing, the emerging markets of Russia and China and South America were taking their place. So they had to start making movies that were similar to the ones that were breaking so hugely abroad.
How has that affected films about women and for women?
Well, not very well. The kinds of movies that they like abroad are movies with huge special effects, movies with gigantic explosions. And moreover, they don't like movies with too much dialogue. So that what they like are movies without cultural nuance, movies that are essentially universal in your ability to understand them. And now, 80% of the business is overseas.
Wow.
And when I began in the business, it was 20%. So women's movies, that is romantic comedies, dramas, they don't play well overseas.
You write that in 2011, Bridesmaids was the only original story in the top 15 films. Women are half of all filmgoers. Why haven't we seen other films challenge the dynamics that you've been speaking of?
There is a shibboleth, a rule, in the movie business, and I can see it in the marketing of the new Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy movie, that women will go to men's movies if they're good, but men won't go to women's movies. Now, it's just not true. But as I was told recently, when you market a movie, listen to this, it's kind of amazing. Do not risk losing a single male viewer by catering to women in your advertising and marketing.
Wow.
Because women will go anyway.
Is it going to be possible to see movies that women see themselves in and are not just going because it's an action movie and it's date night?
This is about making them for less, and this is about great scripts. You know, I can always get a great script made. I just can't get it made at the same price point I could get it made for in the old abnormal. You know, my movies used to be $30, $40 million. I'm going to have to make those movies for $20 million now, or even in some cases, $8 million. So what I think we need to do is maybe make one less marginal tentpole a year for $200 million at the studios and break that $200 million down into $10, $20 million movies that serve another audience. And then also, we have what I call tadpoles, which are the opposite of tentpoles. There are a tremendous amount of young producers making movies for much less money, and we're going to have to starve those movies, but then prove that there's an audience, and women have been incredibly supportive in showing that there is an audience. And we have to be conscious of making those movies good enough for the audience to show up for.
Linda Obst. She's the author of the new book, Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. And consider this. The Heat did way better than expected, coming in a strong second place in the weekend box office. It raked in $40 million. That beat out the action-adventure flick, White House Down.
That's why God made the movie.
On this show, we've been asking filmmakers about the movies they never get tired of watching, the ones they could watch over and over again, including this one from the director of Bridesmaids.
Hey, I'm Paul Feig. I am a director, and I do occasionally write. And my movie that I've seen a million times is Casino Royale, directed by the amazing Martin Campbell and starring Daniel Craig and Ava Green. I'm also an enormous fan of the Ian Fleming books. Once you get into the books of James Bond, you realize that the movies were very different because they were kind of dark. And so when I saw Daniel Craig, this kind of like brooding Bond, it just felt like perfect to me, to the point, and this is heresy to say, I actually think he's my favorite Bond over even Sean Connery, who I loved, you know. But I just think Craig really embodies Ian Fleming's James Bond.
I knew it was too early to promote you.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy, so your mistake will be short-lived.
Actually, the plot of Casino Royale is kind of great because it's basically about a guy, Le Chiffre.
Do you believe in God, Mr. Le Chiffre?
No. I believe in a reasonable rate of return.
Who's this bad guy who basically he's a banker who takes money from militias and terrorist groups and armies of rebels in Africa and stuff, and he takes their millions of dollars and invests them into something that he then manipulates through terrorism.
Do you want a clean kill or do you want to send a message?
We want him alive.
So Bond basically kind of breaks that up, and then this guy is in so much trouble with the militia guys that he took the money from because he lost it all that he has to enter this $10 million buy-in poker game of all the richest people in the world.
You changed your shirt, Mr. Bond. I hope our little game isn't causing you to perspire.
A little. But I won't consider myself to be in trouble until I start weeping blood.
Bond actually beats him and wins the money, and then Le Chiffre comes after him and tries to kill him. And then it goes into some intrigue. But I won't give it away. I don't want to be the spoiler alert guy. There's this whole sequence where Bond is kind of tracking this bomb maker. There's somewhere in Africa, and the guy knows that he's there, and so this guy takes off running, and Bond chases him, and it's an entire parkour opening chase, which is, if you know about parkour, it's kind of the art of running and jumping and this acrobatic sort of gymnastics. And they have this incredible opening where this guy runs into a construction site, climbs up an enormous scaffolding onto this, like, skyscraper they're building, and they eventually end up kind of up on a crane, like, so high up in the air. And it just makes for absolutely the most exciting opening ever of just two guys chasing each other. Daniel Craig really is the Bond that you want to be, or at least I feel like I do. Well, you know, I mean, watching Roger Moore, you go, like, that'd be fun, because it also seems like it's really jaunty and funny and cool. But what's great about the Daniel Craig one is you feel like, okay, he can kind of get out of any situation, and yet maybe he can't. You know, he's still very human.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
That's Freaks and Geeks creator Paul Feig talking about the movie he could watch a million times, Casino Royale. Feig directed the new film, The Heat, starring Sandra Bullock. Last weekend, you might have tuned in to watch aerialist Nick Wallenda cross the Grand Canyon on a wire. Yes, technically, it was a 1,500-foot gorge near the Grand Canyon, but close enough. Now, he's back on the ground in his hometown of Sarasota, Florida, and he joins me from a studio there. Nick, so great to have you here, and I'm so glad to have you back on the ground.
So am I.
Oh, my goodness sakes. Would you describe, from your perspective, exactly what you did last week?
Well, I was the first person in the world to walk a high wire over the Grand Canyon.
What were you feeling? Because I know what I was feeling. I was just feeling dizzy just standing there watching you.
It's a good thing that I don't get dizzy like you were, that's for sure, because of what I'm doing. But it really speaks volumes to the comfort level that I have. Of course, there's nerves involved. Of course, there's butterflies, but it's definitely not a fear.
Whenever I've seen the flying Wallendas, they're, let's face it, they're glamorous and they're wearing spandex, and you were wearing street clothes. You were wearing a t-shirt and jeans. Why?
Because I guess I'm the bad Wallenda.
Ah.
I want to make sure that people can relate to me. That hey, here's a guy who is married with three kids. He eats, sleeps, drinks, bleeds just like the rest of us. Yet he has a very unique occupation.
It's one thing that you do this without any net, but the family's there on the other side, and you're actually teaching them how to do this too. That's hard to understand.
Well, when you say teaching them, I've got three kids, 15, 12, and 10, mm-hmm. and I've never, ever told them to get on a wire before, but all of them are very good on the wire. And I think it has to do with the fact, I know at least in my case, when I was a child, I saw my parents loving and enjoying walking the wire, and I wanted to be a part of it. My three kids all walked a wire. However, I've not let them perform in front of an audience. Very, very minimal, as a matter of fact. And the reason is I don't want them to get that itch. I want them to do what they want to do for their career.
Let's go back seven generations. That's how far your family goes back to, as you say, walking on the wire. Tell us a little bit about your ancestors, your forebears.
My family started performing back in the 1780s over in Bohemia, eventually moving into Europe, into Germany. And they came over to the United States in 1928 to perform on Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus.
You know, it just so happens we try and do a book on each show. And this week, our book is called Queen of the Air, which you may have heard of, or certainly you've heard of the aerialist Lillian Leitzel. She was part of a troupe called the Flying Cadonas. Her husband was Alfred Cadona. I understand there was a bit of a rivalry when your family came from Europe and met the Mexican-born Alfred Cadona.
Our industry at that point especially was extremely competitive. And my great-grandfather, matter of fact, used to rehearse in the middle of the night so his other competitors couldn't see what he was doing. That's how competitive it was. So, yeah, absolutely, there was competitiveness throughout the industry. But I think that's what made our family who they were and made some of the greats, you know, that are out there, including Lillian Leitzel, who I have a poster up in my house of her, and admire her dearly.
Yeah. Nick Willand, I just have to ask you, Leitzel, she did die tragically, not because she made a mistake. The equipment breaks. Did you ever think about equipment?
Yeah, it's oh, absolutely. That's why my father is in charge of it, and my uncle is my lead engineer, because I know I can trust them with my life. Deaths are fairly rare, but I would say 95%+ are rigging related. It's not the actual performer. We train to the extreme for the Grand Canyon. I trained on a cable that was about 1,000 feet long, lower to the ground, of course, and created wind gusts of 45 to 55 miles per hour, including wind speeds of 91 miles per hour, and walked in repetitions to the point where I was walking on that cable four times the distance I would walk over the Grand Canyon. I trained to grab that wire and hold on for 20 to 30 minutes. I also have rescue teams on standby that can be to me within 60 seconds, no matter where I am on that wire.
And the next challenge?
Well, there are many challenges that I have in the works. Several dreams. I want to walk to the top of the Eiffel Tower. I want to walk over the pyramids in Egypt, the Great Wall of China. I'll start working on a walk in New York City, hopefully coming up within a year.
Wow. I really can't wait to see where you go next and want to be there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And it's time now for music. Sé que en la autopista y nadie más entre, que siga creciendo el cementerio del este. The Venezuelan band La Vida Bohème is one of the most popular new bands in all of Latin America. Their first album, Nuestra, was nominated for 2 Latin Grammys. Their new album, Serra, debuted at number 1 on the iTunes Latin Rock and Alternative charts. A few weeks ago, I caught up with the band's lead singer, Henry Dartinay, who spoke to us from his studio in Caracas.
Actually, my last name is Dartinay. It's French. But my dad always says that it's the Dartinay from Carúpano, which is a region from here in Venezuela, making it not Dartinay, but Dartinay.
It makes me think of the Three Musketeers, D'Artagnan.
Yes, they used to call me D'Artagnan in school.
Esquire magazine compared La Vida Bohème to The Clash, thanks to their brash style, their head-on challenges to social stratification. La Vida Bohème's new album is filled with songs about Venezuela, and this new song, called Cementerio del Este, translates literally as Cemetery of the East. It touches upon the class divide that exists in the country.
We have 2 main cemeteries, the East Side Cemetery and the South Side Cemetery. And the East Side Cemetery now, a lot of people like middle class and upper middle class people are buried in the Cementerio del Este. South Side Cemetery is now very crowded, and the worst part of it is that South Side Cemetery, it's beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places in Caracas, and it's left to ruin. And the fact that the deceased are also divided by class, a thing which I always found, you know, awful.
Yeah. You know, the whole panorama makes me think of when you drive into New York City, for example, from JFK Airport, you're going through an enormous cemetery. And then I'm thinking about the terrain of your music. You've got this song, Cementerio del Este. It starts off with this slow chorus of voices. And then it kind of turns into this 80s new wave dance tune. And I was thinking that it reminded me a lot of the 80s band Joy Division and Ian Curtis.
Yes. You know, this whole idea of starting with a very simple thing, you know, with a tonada, which is how the song starts with the voices. And, you know, suddenly entering this, like a new wave thing, for me was also like a metaphor, you know, how something so very pure, like progress, can be very swift, can be very, you know, like elegant, but at the same time it devours things.
You know, I wanted to ask you, since you are in Caracas and your family's been there for generations, this is a country that, you know, here in this country, the U.S., we really think of Venezuela for its political chaos. And you could say that that has occurred long before the death of President Hugo Chavez. One of the songs on this album, El Mito del Progreso, translates to the myth of progress. We hear this loud drumming and what sound like TV ads, which talk about the glory of Venezuela, channels being changed. It really captures, I think, a sense of chaos.
Yeah, I think the myth of progress, it speaks for itself, the title, you know. Sometimes moving forward is not necessarily evolution. And I feel in a way that we forgot that we were supposed to move forward as a country. In some way, I sometimes feel like we haven't moved forward. I think we're living, like a Mexican friend of mine would say, la pausa, the pause. It's like you never get resolution.
Right.
It's just still.
I'm speaking with Henry Dartanay, and he's the lead singer of the Venezuelan band La Vida Boheme. There's this beautiful, beautiful track on your album, La Vida Mejor, and it translates to, loosely, the better life. We're hearing Latin percussion, modern pop, rock, and you mix a lot of things, it seems to me, in studio. Do you ever write these songs thinking you're going to perform them in live concert?
Well, with La Vida Mejor, that song, like the music of it, it happened like very spontaneously. While we were in New York, actually, we were playing like this gig, like a public assembly in Brooklyn. And suddenly we had a problem with the lights, you know, they kind of went out. So we started, you know, just jamming until the problem got fixed. And suddenly the song was developing itself as we played. So I got back to the apartment where we were staying, and this phrase was stuck in the back of my head. So it was, ¿cómo va a ser la vida mejor? How can life gonna be better? ¿Cómo va a ser la vida mejor? ¿Cómo va a ser la vida mejor? Escúchame bien, escucha por favor. ¿Cómo va a ser la vida mejor? And in the same time, I was going through this very, very awful phase in my life, and at the same time, I was comparing it to the one of my country, and La Vida Mejor was like therapy for me. It was like saying, I will accept this, even if it's bad or good. The better life for me, the translation of it, La Vida Mejor, what I love about the song, I think it's a celebration of existentialism, about doubt, you know? How could you tell life is going to be better? Maybe it won't be.
How old are you?
I'm 24.
I think you're just young enough to be existential, Henry.
Yes.
Well, I think it has been a vida mejor, a better life for you.
Yes.
Thank you so, so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. A real honor, really.
It has been a real pleasure for us. That's Henry Dartanay, and he's the lead singer of the Venezuelan band La Vida Boheme. Gracias.
Gracias a ti.
For the week ending June 30th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Amy Held, Rachel Rude, Liz Baker, and me, Becky Sullivan. A fond farewell also to Lily Percy, who next month heads off to Minnesota to help produce the radio show On Being. Our intern is Jan Stewart, the man behind the boards is Daniel Shukin. Mithoni Maturi is our senior editor, Steve Lichtai, our senior producer, and our host, Jackie Leiden. You can follow us on Twitter at NPRWATC, or NPRWATSY, as we like to call it. As always, we'll be back next week with more great stories and features from our show. And you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.